From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally. And this morning we speak with cognitive scientist Paco Calvo, who talks about the new science of plant intelligence in his book, Plant a Sapiens.
Then writer Paul Bogard talks about the importance of the night sky and the impact of darkness on all forms of life. These guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
In recent years, scientists have devoted considerable time to exploring animal cognition and intelligence with remarkable results. Nearly every week, there are new headlines about how smart animals are. But now, it's time to turn our attention from fauna to flora and ask the next logical question. Are we smart enough to know how smart plants are? Well, joining us now to discuss some of these extraordinary findings is cognitive scientist Paco Calvo. He is the director of the MINT lab at the University of Murcia in Spain. MINT stands for Minimal Intelligence. His new book is called Planta Sapiens, the New Science of Plant Intelligence. Paco Calvo, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, hi.
And what a concept this is. And I'm wondering if you can just tell us how you came to be so obsessed with this.
Oh, my God. I think that's a problem I have in general, you know. I have this tendency to become obsessed with anything I get into, right? So I couldn't help. In a sense, I couldn't help it. Once I got into plants, like, as you said, the next logical step was going from non-human animals into, hey, other forms of life, right, such as plants. And then the more I digged into it, and you know, the more I thought to myself, like, oh wow, I mean, isn't it crazy that we make this extra effort to think that other animals are smart enough, and yet why should that be something that just belongs to us, right? What might be the case if we could envisage the very idea of intelligence belonging to the tree of life itself, right? So that's what took me to plants in a very obsessive way. By the way, let me say that when you mentioned minimal intelligence lab, I think that minimal intelligence has to do with our own intelligence, how minimal human intelligence is when we keep missing that intelligence spreads out there, you know.
Yeah, I love it. Actually, that name is something that you can ponder for a while, the minimal intelligence lab.
And absolutely.
And yeah, as you say, either humans or plants. So there's this concept of something called neuronal intelligence, which we as Homo sapiens, shall we say, we think that's what defines intelligence, and that would be brain-centered intelligence. Sure. But you see that anything that is cellular, it's kind of a basic element, is that there is awareness. Can you explain that a little more?
Well, if you think about it, it's funny because if you read the book in the preface, I speak about navel gazing, right? So we are so talking about obsessions. We are so obsessed as a species, as Homo sapiens, about navel gazing, like thinking that we are somehow special or something like, I like to say that, you know, I always say, look, point number one is that we are not that special, right? And all these obsessions about navel gazing have to do not just with neuronal tissue, like we are neuron-centric, or we are zoo-centric if we just think about animals, or we are anthropocentric if we just think about human animals. So we have all these centric or human-centric or animal-centric or neuron-centric or neocortex-centric, like mammals, like only mammals, because only mammals have a neocortex. Oh, if you have a neocortex, you've got to be smart. If you lack a neocortex, that's bad news. You cannot be smart because you don't have a neocortex, right? And I always thought there is something very wrong about it, about the way to approach the issue in terms of, you know, check, 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 as if we are checking boxes. Oh, do you have this? Do you have that? Oh, you don't? Oh, I'm so sorry for you. Then if you think about cells themselves, as you mentioned, let's do a little trip. Okay, mental trip. Let's go back, traveling in time, like 2 billion years ago or 3.5 billion years ago, when all life was unicellular. Okay, so when there was not any form of life that wasn't unicellular, if you get to that stage, you see there is a blurred distinction. We lose the divide. There is not any sharp divide anymore in between being an organism and being a cell, because we have the idea that organisms are built up out of individual cells. You pile up a lot of cells together and you end up with an organism. But what happens when all life was unicellular? The cell is the organism itself, right? And then you think, oh, and cells, unicellular organisms, were doing great for billions of years, right? Thousands and thousands of years, they were doing great. And by doing great, I don't simply mean to say, oh, lucky them, they were able to, you know, to keep reproducing or to keep, you know, they didn't go extinct. Well, think that cells, when I say that they did something, that they had to be doing something really well, it means they had to be smart in the way we mean, right? Sapient. Like, and then that has to do with awareness. Like, oh, the cell itself needs to do some meaning making, needs to have some understanding of its surroundings, what's the local environment, what's good and what's bad. And if there is something which can be good or bad for the cell itself, like the type of environment that can bring good or bad news, which means you can learn to develop or to trigger some form of, you know, avoidance behavior. Hey, I'm gonna get out of here. This is bad news. I don't want to be around here. It's too acid, it's too salty, it's whatever. So if you get an understanding of the sense of awareness that you need to evolve as a unicellular, imagine when you're a plant made out of so many different cells, right? So yeah, but and again, we are talking about forms of life that have no neurons, and yet they've got to be doing something right. Otherwise they wouldn't be here.
So this is a fascinating book. I have been on vacation with my family and it's a constant, okay, listen to this fact and listen to this fact. I think they're gonna be very happy when I'm done with the book. But again, fascinating book, something I never really thought about. We're used to seeing plants grow and wrap themselves around fences and vines and such, but to really understand that this is a whole new level of intelligence. And so what, through the course of this book and your work, what have you been able to come to a definition of what intelligence is?
Yeah, I see what you mean. And I understand there is some concern about terminological or semantic issues. So some people say, hey, but hold on a sec, before you get to, you know, don't get so excited. First things first, tell me what you mean by intelligence, right? So that's a fair question. It's a fair question, but let me say that my answer, despite some people not finding it fair enough, if you think about it twice, is the very same type of answer or the very same type of approach that we use when we speak of animal cognition. So I would say that there is not a set in stone definition of intelligence, but not to be applied to plants. There is not a set in stone definition of intelligence or of cognition or of life for that matter. I mean, think that biologists, if you go to a conference of biologists, even among themselves, biologists, they don't agree with each other as to what life is, what is the definition of life, right? So the same happens with in psychological terms, with the notion of learning. What does learning mean? The notion of memory, what is to store information as memory? The definition of decision-making, what is to make decisions? What is to be intelligent? So the more I was trying to find that type of definition that could get us off the ground, I realized that we were getting trapped in conceptual discussions or terminological discussions or semantic disputes. Let's just look at, we are talking about behavior, okay? First point number one is that, think about it, you cannot see intelligence. So intelligence is not something that I can observe as such, not even in humans. I don't see intelligence in a human being. I can observe behavior. So the type of behavior that you display, then I can think, oh, is that pattern of behavior sophisticated enough to deserve the label intelligent? Is that intelligent behavior? Then you might think, okay, for a behavior to count as intelligent, it's not enough to simply say it's adaptive behavior, because adaptive behavior is what any form of life by default has, otherwise wouldn't be here. What we said about cells, right? So, okay, yeah, it's got to be adaptive and not maladaptive behavior. But then on top of that, think that it's got to be flexible enough, because it cannot be the type of behavior that delivers, like, you know, knee-jerk responses, like, you know, one-to-one input-output. It's got to be flexible enough, because think of a plant. A plant is not simply responding to light as in, you know, phototropic behavior, leaning towards the light, as my plants now on the windowsill, or geotropic behavior, like my roots or the roots of this plant, of this potted plant, like growing downwards following the gravity vector. So you don't respond to sources of stimulation on a one-to-one basis. That could be knee-jerk responses. Responses have got to be, on top of being adaptive, has got to be globally adaptive, that you need to make up your mind, to come to terms, to find a trade-off in between all these sources of stimulation. So I'm being affected not just by light and gravity, but by chemicals, by king, by non-king, by competition, by the vicinity, by many, many, many different patterns of stimulation impinging on my sensory periphery nonstop, round the clock, right? So it's got to be behavior that is not just adaptive, but flexible, flexible enough to change gear, as the situation demands. And on top of that, you might say, hey, it's got to be sufficiently anticipatory. You don't want to be simply reacting to what's happening. You want to think ahead of time. You want to behave proactively. I want to go there. I want to, because I'm a vine and I need to find a host, right, to climb up and do photosynthesis. So if you put it all together, we are talking of behavior which is globally adaptive, which is flexible enough, which is anticipatory, and which is goal-directed. If you have all those things, then I think we are talking intelligent behavior.
So with all of these behaviors that you observe, research, and in writing this book, was there a specific behavior that was your favorite, that really stood out?
Yeah, actually, I think it's really difficult to get to put your finger into one particular pattern of behavior, which is like the one. I'll give you some examples, but I think this is a risky exercise for people to try at home, because when people read the book, I'm pretty sure people will have their own preferred either potted plant, if they have some domestic or indoor plant, or in their garden, outdoors, or if they go for a stroll in the forest. So whichever sort of encounter, interaction they have with plants, I'm sure everyone will have their own preferred plant. But let me say something which is kind of risky to go for one pattern of plant behavior, because sometimes we fall prey, even without realizing, we fall prey of our own prejudices. For example, we tend to focus or to pay attention to what's fast. And then people like, for example, Mimosa pudica, because it folds its leaves when you touch it. Actually, you don't even need to time lapse Mimosa, right? You just touch it and you can see it folding to the naked eye, okay? And people say, oh, wow, look, I can touch it and it just folds in real time. I don't need to time lapse or watch any clip or anything. I just see it, right? Or the Venus flytrap, you can see a carnivorous plant. Venus flytrap, you can see how it snapshots the trap. The problem with these examples is that however they sophisticated and jaw-dropping they are, they deliver, in my opinion, the wrong idea. We try to put, like, as if we have a measuring rod and we locate or put plants on this spectrum from dumb to more intelligent, as if they were closer to us. Okay, the faster ones are more smart because they are fast. And by doing this, we might be missing smart plant behavior, which might be real, real sophisticated, really flexible, really anticipatory, as we said, and yet might not be that conspicuous to the naked eye. So we may not be able to appreciate it, because plants might be doing whatever it is that they are doing for themselves, of course. They are not influencers trying to show off, right? So they don't want to show off or to flag their intelligence to us for us to appreciate it. So by thinking of what comes natural to us, we might be missing a lot of forms of intelligence. See the point? Now, one example, for example, which is difficult to appreciate, go below ground. to watch the roots. As you can imagine, that's a difficult business because, you know, they are growing below ground and you cannot time lapse them without, you know, some radical intervention. We have to approach the observation of root behavior, how roots grow indirectly, right? Mm-hmm. But when you do that with many sophisticated experimental designs, you can see, for example, this is one neat example of plant intelligence, that if you have a plant, you split the root, the primary root in two, so that they can grow into two different pots. So you can manipulate the amount of nutrients that you put in each pot, right? So to see which root is growing more or less depending on which pot it's into. So by doing that, you can see, for example, that a plant with two roots growing into two different pots will grow more roots, not in the pot that has more amount of nutrients, but in the pot that will have more amount of nutrients in the future. Think about it. We said plants need to predict the future. I don't want to grow where it's good now. I want to grow where it will be good news in the forthcoming future. And because growth takes time, they will need to time to clock to say, hey, how long is it going to take for me to get there? Oh, I don't want to get there. And then, oh, things moved. Now the target is somewhere else. If you keep pushing the target, right? Kicking the ball. No, you want to be at the right time at the right place. And that takes time. So sometimes you find that, oh, why is this root growing or the plant growing more roots into this pot which has less amount of nutrient? Oh, because it's on the rise. It's a gradient. So the plant is actually picking the gradient and cares about the relative value, not the absolute value. That's, I think, a pretty good example of plant intelligence.
Yeah.
And then another example is if you talk about not just the root system, but the root shoot apparatus. They've got to strike a balance to talk to each other such that the shoots will be growing in a way that is also going to affect the way roots compensate and grow. Mm. So there is a communication, signaling and communication throughout the whole plant body, because what matters above ground counts below ground and vice versa.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Paco Calvo about his new book, Planta Sapiens. It's the new science of plant intelligence. And Paco, as you're talking, it's been making me think of my 83-year-old mother, she's not a master gardener technically, but she has 2 acres of gardens out, and she spends all day long in the summer. And when I visit her, she very often is transplanting one plant from one bed to another. And the whole time she's saying, oh, this plant likes this and that plant likes this. And it's now making me think that we do believe that plants are sentient beings and therefore intelligent. We just don't really notice it, even though, like my mother talks about, oh, they like this, not that. So I'm wondering how we can be more cognizant and aware when we see plants and how to recognize their intelligence.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's so difficult. For one thing, we need to make a mental exercise. So we need to forget about ourselves, okay, in a sense. Imagine you had to appreciate plant intelligence even if human race or civilization wasn't here. If imagine you travel to another planet, you find green life plants, and there are no humans around. How would you appreciate, how would you ever to tell whether this other form of life was intelligent or not without relating it to the way it's interacting with you? Think of the way we approach plant life. The example of your mother has a lot to do with not just gardening, but also agriculture. We've been sculpting their phenotype through agriculture through thousands of years. So, you know, think of what's happened in the last 10,000 years, approx. So we've been providing the environment to the plants to thrive, but not to thrive according to their needs. We've been using them, or if I may, exploiting them for their yield, to pick their fruit. So in a sense, domestication, the very fact that we have domesticated them, we have changed their behavior. It's so difficult because sometimes I like to think of actually, if you think now, before you ask, or was it Katie, she asked about the examples of smart plant intelligence or smart plant behavior. And I gave you a couple of examples below ground. We may have talked about wild or plants or weeds, Because think about it, if you have weeds, weeds are the counterexample to domesticated exemplars. You pluck them and you pluck them and you try to get rid of them. And the more you try to get rid of them, the more they thrive. So this is that like a pattern of coevolution. It's a competition, right? It's like, you know, like a pattern of coevolution in between a pollinator and a flowering plant. So something similar, right? So the more you try, the more they have to become smart. Yeah. With domesticated plants in your garden, your mother's acres, she's caring for them in summer, replanting them, you know, airing the soil, changing, putting, so all this work gardeners do to their plants, in a sense, might be putting the focus on something that might not have anything to do with their own intelligence as such. We might be thinking they care about this because it's what we care about. Hmm. So the question is how to develop empathy? Well, empathy to be developed requires for us to put ourselves in their shoes. And how can I put myself in the shoes of a plant? Well, point number one is that's what I meant about to forget about yourself, to try to picture what is it that the plant cares about. And that requires that we expand the time, so the time scale. Because usually the problem in not appreciating intelligence is that we share different time scale and a spatial scale. So think of the example of the cell. If you thought, you know, why it's so difficult for people to come to terms with the idea that the cell itself is sentient or intelligent? Because we don't share an spatial scale in which we can interact with each other. So I can walk my pet, my dog or my cat and touch it and pet it and interact with my hands. And, you know, I can shake hands with you. We can say, hey, give me five, whatever. We can interact physically, but you cannot do that with something which is micro, with a cell. So the lack of a spatial scale of interaction doesn't allow us to develop empathy. And the same happens with plants when you move from the spatial to the temporal scale. So the first point to me is to try to observe plants extended in time through a long exposure. The longer, the better. And forget about what's demanding at the level of the fast and furious, which is what animals do. Yeah. So, yeah, but again, that's not something you can do. You know, we have some tips in the book, but it takes time.
Right. I have to ask you before we let you go, and we're almost out of time, because I know our listeners are going to be wondering, you know, we've all known that if you talk to plants and come up close to them and breathe on them and play certain types of music, we believe, right? We've been told that they respond. And little experiments like that, can you confirm or deny that that's a real thing?
Yeah. Well, in fact, that's a great example to respond or to go back to the previous question, because certainly we can speak of plants' bioacoustics. So in a sense, plants think about the plant body itself. So when we spoke before of all the information impinging, the sensory information impinging on the surface of the plant, it could be light, gravity pull, chemicals, we said king, non-king. So all this information, part of it, of course, is mechanical stimulation. So plants are blown by the wind. They are they can feel physical impact. If a pollinator is landing on the plant, it can feel it, touch. Of course, they are feeling all these forms of mechanical stimulation round the clock. Now, what's risky, again, that's what I said before, we need to forget about ourselves, is that we might be thinking by default that what we enjoy, they've got to enjoy too. So it is true that they are sensing all these patterns of mechanical stimulation, but that doesn't mean that the type of meaning that you project onto them is the same one they will be appreciating. So to speak, the fact that you enjoy classical music doesn't mean that they've got to enjoy it. That doesn't mean either that there are no vibrational information that it's relevant to them, but the type of relevant information that is relevant to them might be something that you are not even thinking of. It could be just a vibrational pattern that is telling the plant, hey, great news, pollinators in the vicinity. then rise the concentration of pollen, rise the concentration of this chemical to attract the pollinator. And that's something that you might be missing completely because you are just thinking of the type of music that you do enjoy.
Section where you talk about how plants can't migrate and animals can, and just that adaptability has completely changed my view of every plant around me. They adapt. The adaptability of plants is startling.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and I hope people enjoy the book. I mean, that's obviously one of the reasons to write it, is for people to know if it's a little step in allowing or helping people change their mind. That's great, because we certainly need to change our mind with respect to plants and the planet. So I hope that helps, if only a little.
And the book is Planta Sapiens. It's the new science of plant intelligence. And our guest is Paco Calvo. I think for anyone who loves plants, they simply must read your book. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Well, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
While most of the world is concerned with light and illuminating the world around us at all times, our next guest, writer Paul Bogard, is focused on darkness, and not only as access to the stars above, but that nighttime is just as vital as the day. Paul is the author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light, and is a frequent contributor to the New York Times, Audubon, and National Geographic, to name just a few. Paul, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, my pleasure.
So we're all mostly starting to understand and appreciate the importance of light pollution and dark skies and reducing, you know, the light that permeates the night. But as you point out, night or darkness is so much more than just the absence of light. It's more than just a conduit to view the night skies. Darkness is actually its own ecosystem. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, sure. I guess I'd start with something that a biologist told me when I was doing research for the book, which is that all life on Earth has evolved with bright days. We obviously need light, but also with dark nights, and we need darkness as well. So, you know, up and down the food chain, that includes human beings, any kind of living thing, we need darkness. And so this relatively recent explosion of artificial lighting into ecosystems has really had a negative effect, I guess I'd say. I only pause because, the studies haven't caught up with probably where we are. I was just talking with somebody who said, you know, there isn't a lot of studies showing that wildlife is impacted, for example, by artificial light. And I just said, that's just because we haven't studied it. Everything we do study seems to reflect the fact that being exposed to all this light at night is not good for living creatures. And that includes human beings. Nighttime is really a wonderful time for wildlife, for the wild world. It's when so much of the wild world comes alive, especially now when humans dominate the day. A lot of creatures have evolved to depend on darkness. And one thing that's really interesting is we're finding a lot of animals that are increasingly spending more time in the darkness, coming alive at night as well, because they know that's the time when they don't have to spend all their time avoiding human beings as they do during the daytime. So the importance of nighttime, it's always been important. We have so many nocturnal creatures and then even more crepuscular creatures active at dawn and dusk. So that's always been true. But then you add in the dominance of the daytime by human beings, and I think night has become even more important. Darkness has become even more important for the wild world.
Yeah, I was fascinated with that article that you wrote in Audubon in 2021 regarding the migration of birds at night. And 594 million birds migrated one night in September, spanning the Gulf of Mexico up to the upper reaches of the U.S. That's an astounding number of creatures, and that's just in one swath. What other animals do we find utilizing the night as much as birds do?
Yeah, the Actually, the animals that use the airspace are is a good place to look with that. So obviously the birds, Scott Wiedensahl, who's a well-known writer about birds, has said that if we could see nocturnal migration at night, it would be the greatest wildlife spectacle on the planet. And I think when you look at those maps of using weather radar to show us the migrations at night, it really reflects that fact. It's just this unbelievable movement of birds, of biomass overhead that most people are oblivious to. We don't even know that it's happening. So, but then insects is another huge one. Lots of nocturnal insects, a lot of insects on the move, certainly bats using nighttime as well. So that airspace, people talk about the new field of aeroecology, the study of the life in the air. So nighttime is really important to them. And then down on the ground, you have all sorts of, it's just, up and down really throughout the ecosystem, from mammals to amphibians to reptiles to, you name it, active in the dark. And even, one of the ways that we know this is to look at the impacts to creatures. And we even see impacts to, for example, fish of being exposed at night. It changes their behavior and that kind of thing. So again, nighttime is just I like to think of it as when the wild world comes alive, and the impact from artificial lighting is not good.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Paul Bogard about the night skies. His book is called The End of Night: Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Paul, you published this book in 2014, and I was going to bring up the point that it seems to me that in recent years, maybe your message and all of the, it's not the only book that you've written on the topic, have really gotten cities and towns especially, to bring about some code changes and some policy changes about dark skies. And so I'm wondering what you've seen. Has there been a positive change, or are we still going more and more in the last 9 years since you wrote the book in the direction of light night skies?
It's a wonderful question, and the answer is yes. So there has been, I think I had kind of a fantasy that when the book came out, everybody would read it and everybody would kind of react by saying, oh my gosh, the way that we light is really dumb, we should change it, and that there would sort of be this wash of change across the land as people figured it out. And obviously that didn't happen. But there has been a lot of change in the almost decade since the book has come out. A lot more people are aware of our overuse and misuse of light at night, of light pollution. You see a lot more activism, a lot more advocacy for the issue, a lot more. The International Dark Sky Association has protected or helped various communities protect dark areas, dark communities. The National Park Service has really taken up the mantle for sure. Various towns and cities across the country have stronger lighting ordinances, that kind of thing. So there's been a lot of positive change. But at the same time, one of the biggest things that's happened since the book came out is just the tsunami of LED lighting, which was really barely on the radar when I published the book. It's amazing, in not even a decade, how we've changed from being dominated by electronic light or electric lighting, which is what we all grew up with, to electronic lighting, which light emitting diodes, LEDs, now in, every city across the country. And that has made, for the most part, has made things worse, because we've just taken the efficiency that comes with LEDs and thought, well, we can just cost the same, we'll just use more light. And so at the same time, you have a lot of people more aware of light pollution. You also actually have the growth of light. There was just a study that came out in Science magazine that documented that over the last 8 years, the sky glow, which is essentially the light in the sky worldwide, has doubled in the last 8 years and continues to grow at about 10% worldwide. So,
wow.
good things are happening, but also the problem continues to grow.
So do you think that sky glow doubling worldwide is attributable to the LEDs?
A lot of it is. I mean, some of it is just there are more people everywhere, and so we bring our lights wherever we go. Some of it is developing countries lighting up their nights, you know, and unfortunately, the West has spread not only our technology of lighting around the world, but also sort of our thinking about lighting around the world. So, you know, that has led to the increase, but I think it really is certainly in the States and in North America and Europe, and then cities around the world, it's been the growth of LEDs that has really led the increase in lighting.
So I know Lynn and I, and from reading your book, you as well, grew up where we had access to the night sky, where we could see the constellations, where I think we are fortunate in the fact that we can really navigate ourselves within this space we call Earth and even our own homes according to the night sky. You know, I definitely orient myself to the night sky. And so much of the light pollution discussion is based around seeing the stars, which we all agree is very, very important, because, you know, your daughter will grow up not seeing them all. And even in Park City, where we've typically been dark, it's getting lighter every day. No pun intended there. But what are the health effects of light pollution for humans? You know, we just talked about how it affects animals, but there's got to be effects on us, whether it's our light receptors in our eyes, not being able to fall asleep. What are some of those health effects that we're seeing?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, the problem of light pollution is so relatively recent, you know, I say over just the last few decades, that again, the studies, as with wildlife, are continually coming in. But what we find, what seems like every study that we do tells us, is that there is an impact to our physical health, certainly. And I would also add to our psychological and even spiritual health as well. It has a real impact on us physically, specifically, seems to impact us in three main ways. Disrupts our circadian rhythms. So those internal rhythms in our bodies that orchestrate all our different organs. Exposure to light at night seems to disrupt the circadian rhythms. That's folks working the night shift, especially, are impacted that way. Contributes to sleep disorders. So sleep disorders are tied to every major disease that we're dealing with: cancer, obesity, diabetes, depression, you name it. And being exposed at night seems to contribute to sleep disorders. And then what they found is that exposure to light at night disrupts the production of the hormone melatonin. And a lack of melatonin in the bloodstream has been tied to an increased risk for breast cancer, prostate cancer, that kind of thing. So in a way, you know, it's kind of funny to say that, unfortunately, we can't make a direct link between, you know, being exposed to light at night and certain types of cancer, right? It seems funny to say that, but in a way, it'd be nice if we could make that direct link, because it would probably get people's attention, you would think, if we could say that. But I think that there's enough already. I mean, and this was true 10 years ago. I was certainly convinced there's enough sort of circumstantial evidence in the studies that we've done that at the very least would say, you know, being exposed to artificial light at night is not good for us physically. And again, I would also add psychologically and spiritually as well. I mean, just as you say, you know, to grow up in an experience, to grow up in a situation where you can walk out at night, and as I like to say, you know, come face to face with the universe, is really, I think, an intangible value, but so important to us psychologically, to be able to look up and see something much greater than ourselves, priceless. And we've largely lost that experience in most places across the country. And then, you know, spiritually, just thinking about all the values of reflecting on our place in the world in relation to the rest of creation, that kind of thing. Just, it's one of those things, like, everybody would agree that it's important, but nobody knows how to value it. And I'm sure we'll talk about this, but, you know, when people come along and say, yeah, but we need all this light for safety and security, so we got to light everything up. And it's, you know, it's hard. How do you How do you balance those concerns with these health concerns?
Well, you're right. In terms of lighting everything up, in your book, you talk about the trespassing of light. You know, as when we have neighbors, we're very aware of the sound that they make, or their shrubbery growing over our fence, or whatever it might be. But we just simply let their obnoxious, massive light go all night without ever raising a stink. And we do have a right to darkness if that's what we're choosing. But because it permeates everything, is there a way that we can prevent some of that trespassing?
Yeah, so the phrase light trespass is one that I've always been drawn to, in part because we live, as you say, you know, in this country where everybody's so, you know, aware of property rights and don't trespass on my, you know, property and my rights and et cetera. But then at night, we just let our light, you know, go every which way. And a lot of us have experiences where our neighbor's lighting is coming into our house, you know, at night. So, yeah, I mean, you know, one of the key things that we can do with this issue in general, but certainly with light trespasses, to shield our lights, you know, so the lights are only going downward where we need them. That actually would improve our safety. It makes it easier to see at night. It would cut down on all the light that's going up into the sky and making no one any safer. It would cut down on the ecological costs, and it would cut down on this problem that we're talking about, which is light trespass. If every light were shielded, so the light was just going down, it would, you know, more or less keep that light on the property that's meant to be lit up, as opposed to shining onto the neighbor's property as well. So there are definitely things we can do. And of course, you know, turning your lights off. I mean, we have this obsession with leaving lights on all night long, everywhere, no matter if there are people there or not or anything. We could do a lot better with that side of things as well.
It's funny. I'm sure our listeners are thinking about this now, that trespass, the light trespass. And I think if I live in this neighborhood that is removed from town. It's very rural. It's beautiful. And yet there's one neighbor who I'm not even sure why they feel like they have to light up the entire place. And it does impact the night sky. And all of the neighbors sort of talk about it, you know, good naturedly, but say, has anyone brought this up to our one neighbor? And no one has. And in the last house I lived in, the neighbors, it was a second home. And this happens a lot where they want it to seem like there's someone there, even though they're not there because it's a second or third or fourth home. And so they leave lights on, you know, around the clock. And it makes me wonder if that should not be part of an ordinance. We do have an ordinance, and I'm not sure how it reads in Park City, but it's about downlighting. Lighting must be down. And maybe that's just on new builds. Maybe it's not addressing the existing issues. Do you see that sort of thing?
Oh yeah, all the time. I mean, a lot of ordinances have a grandfather clause or whatever they call it. So if, you know, your neighbor's light was up before the ordinance went in, they probably would be allowed to keep it. And then there's just, you know, the problem of enforcement, where nowhere are there, you know, light police going around checking the lighting. So it largely falls on neighbors maybe to call attention to it. And it's a real challenge, and it's a shame, you know, that one person or one building, one company can, you know, have such a ruinous effect on all the other neighbors. Mm-hmm. For sure.
In your TED talk that I believe is from about 6 years ago, you do a few things that really fascinated me. One is talking about Vincent van Gogh's Starry, Starry Night and how he used to write to his brother Theo about the lights in Paris, which is kind of a joke now, because how could you ever see now any night sky? Or rather, he talked about the night sky in Paris. And then you go to the very spot in Arles in the south of France where Van Gogh painted Starry Night, and you show a picture of what the night sky looks from the very spot that he painted that. Tell us what it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a great experience to go to Arles and to see where Van Gogh painted actually Starry Night over the Rhone, which is less famous than the one everybody knows, but it's still a beautiful painting of the river and the Big Dipper in the sky, which actually astronomers have figured out that it was behind him. He just used a little artistic license and put it in front of him. And, you know, I went there originally to the site during the day, and there's a, you know, a big poster with the painting on it and says, you know, essentially on this spot, Van Gogh painted this painting. And I thought, well, I'll come back at night. And when I came back at night, there was this just, you know, it was all lit up, bright light kind of right at your feet, which kind of obliterated any, you weren't able to see basically beyond the poster. And it was just, you know, so ironic of where we've come over the last, you know, 125 years or whatever it is.
Well, I know some of your articles have been focused on the safety of lighting. You know, we think that the more lights we have, the safer we'll be. But I think we've all had this experience where, referring to Edward Abbey when he talks about in Desert Solitaire, the whole idea of having the flashlight. And when you're looking at the ground with the flashlight, that's all you see is what's in front of you in that little dome of light, where the rest of it becomes very dark. I've had friends that stood up from the fire, walked away in the desert, and they're gone for a half an hour, and they climb back into the campsite, bloody and bruised because they fell off a cliff because their eyes hadn't adjusted. And so there's the two safety factors. One, are we losing the ability to see in the dark because we have so much light around us? Are those cones and rods not functioning the way they should? And I guess my second part to that question is, does all of this light really keep us safe?
Yeah, I mean, on some level, that is the question when we talk about this issue. To the sort of, you know, our eyes adjusting, it's really fascinating to look back at the history and to think about how in the time of gaslighting, gas lamps, I guess would be a better phrase, that, you know, our eyes adjusted to the dark, and we saw those gas lamps as relatively bright because of that. And they served as good artificial light. Now, when you see a gas lamp, you're just, at least I have been sort of shocked by how not bright they are, but that's because our eyes have never adjusted to the darkness. We're so exposed to artificial light at night that in many cities now, your eyes just basically never adjust to darkness. That's how bright it is outside. And then we go inside and, you know, it's all bright in our house as well. So yeah, that is a unique experience. I think a lot of people are kind of shocked by when they do get to go outside, sit around a campfire or what have you, and have their eyes adjust to darkness and to realize how much we actually can see at nights on very little natural lights, and how the instant you turn on a flashlight or somebody, you know, flashes their headlights past you and you're just instantly kind of blinded. We don't have that experience very often. On the issue of safety, I was just talking with a reporter the other day, and they were asking me all about, you know, the value of seeing the sky and the stars and, you know, how important it is for wildlife and et cetera, et cetera. And they didn't ask me about safety. And I just said, you know, you really need to say something about safety and security, because so many people listen to a discussion like this, and in the back of their mind, or maybe even in the front of their mind, they're thinking, yes, but we need all this light for safety and security. We've been brought up to think that. We've been brought up to think that because some light can help us be safer and more secure, that ever more light will help us be more safe and more secure. And, you know, where does that stop? And I think it's a complex issue. It's not simple. It's not light is good and dark is bad. It's some light can be good. Oftentimes darkness can be better. When you see bright lights, it makes it harder for your eyes to see. Bright lights tend to cast shadows. They give the illusion of safety. Oftentimes we think, oh, it's all lit up, it must be safe. You know, it's an illusion. It's an illusion that bright lights keep the bad guys away. I mean, one of the first things that I heard when I was doing research was the bad guys are as afraid of the dark as we are, right? They want something to be lit up so that they can see as well, whether it's a house or a possible victim, that kind of thing. So at the very least, I just wish we could get away from this idea that ever increasing light will make us ever safer. It just doesn't, the equation falls apart pretty quickly. we could do a lot for safety at night and for all these issues that we're talking about by shielding our lights so the light is just coming down where we need it. So that would make it easier to see, probably improve our safety actually. But this idea that we just, let's keep lighting everything brighter as a response to, basically as a response to our fear of the dark, which is what so much of it comes down to.
Right. Paul, we're out of time, but I just wanted along those lines to recommend that TED Talk that you gave, because you also do this great little experiment in it showing how light actually is blinding you from being able to see the bad guy, right? And then when you put your hand up and shield the light, oh, then suddenly there's the bad guy. It's a little experiment that you stage, but it does really hit home that notion of, you know, if you downlight just enough light, then you're not going to be blinded by the light. So that was great.
Well, thank you, Paul, for joining us today and enlightening us on the importance of the dark. I'm sure you've never heard that pun. To read more of Paul's articles and find his books, visit paul-bogard.com.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Paul.
And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.